tonight's opening speaker, Melissa T.
This is crazy. All right. My name is Melissa, and I am an alcoholic.
Hi, Melissa. We love you, Melissa. Lots and lots and lots. And
get some.
Oh, my. Oh, my God. I was trying to figure out if I still qualify for an ASCIPOC convention on the way here, and I don't know. I heard that one of the qualifications is that I still require spiritual growth, and that's absolutely true. My first ASCIPOC convention was in 1999. By the grace of my higher power, which I choose to call many things, including God, and the program and fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, I have not found it necessary to take a drink or put a mood-altering chemical in my body since December 12, 1998. And in keeping with the theme, the age of miracles, that is a miracle. And anyone in this room is a miracle. And I really, when Katie texted me to ask me if I could be here to speak, I was on a plane leaving St. Louis, going to Philadelphia, and I had just left the woman that had 12-stepped me into this program. And I hadn't seen her in 13 years. I got sober here in Prescott, Arizona. I drank here in Prescott, Arizona. And everybody knew my business here in Prescott, Arizona. It is a small town. Yeah. And it's a great place to get sober because everybody knows your business. And when everybody knows your business, it's kind of hard to hide. You know, it's a really good place. I looked up the word miracle, and I just wanted to share it with you. So Webster's Dictionary defines it as an extraordinary event manifesting divine intervention in human affairs. And I certainly do believe that the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is an absolutely divinely guided program. I absolutely believe that Bill and Bob were conduits of something much greater than themselves to develop such a thing that could get two people connected to discuss a life-threatening terminal illness and provide something that was our medicine. And that medicine is connection. This is a disease of isolation, and I really believe that by coming into Alcoholics Anonymous, we begin to relieve that isolation, and connection is what I needed when I got here. I don't really want to share my story in 15 minutes, but basically I hit bottom in this town. If you're a female in this room, a lot of what I'd like to share tonight is really for you. I started drinking when I was 14 years old. My first drink was a drink of Everclear.
Getting it done.
Yep. Yeah, I was getting it done. Yeah, that's what he said. When it went down, it came right back up. You know, and so I looked at my friends and I said, we need to find something to mix this with. And it was on. And I knew immediately that I had to mix it. I was an alcoholic from the very beginning. And I got drunk that night, and when I got home, my mother wouldn't let me into the house. And I looked at her, and I said, shut the fuck up. And I pushed her out of this way, and I went straight to my room. I was an angry drunk from the very beginning. And And this is a really, it's just a really interesting disease, how it manifests. And I'm sure most of you in here are not just straight up alcoholics. I know I am not. My first drug of choice was hallucinogens. And my first bottom was dropping out of high school because I had so many ditches from using so much LSD. I was 15 years old when I hit my first bottom. And I continued to go to college and do all of those things. And then my next bottom, I'm just going to qualify really quickly. My next bottom was, I was 18 years old and I was at a party and I made a conscious decision to get drunk that night. And I think someone slipped me a date rape drug and I got raped. And I woke up and he was next to me in the bed. And I called the police, and the police told me because I wasn't drunk, I couldn't press charges. And so that was another bottom. I didn't drink for another 2 years after that. And then I started again. My friend had a 21st birthday, and we went to Laughlin, Nevada. And she was... Her father was the vice president of what was then Valley National Bank and what is now Bank of America. And he rented out a whole top floor of a hotel. I went there. I started everything that night. I was there with a boyfriend. I didn't go home with the boyfriend. I was lost for 3 days. I went home with a pit boss. And that's, you know, it's how I drink. And it's how I use. And I drank for another 7 years. So my drinking was marked by many, many, many serial monogamous relationships. I was always in a relationship from the time I was 14 years old until I was 27. There was a 3-year period where I wasn't, and when I wasn't, I really wasn't in a relationship. And the last relationship I had was a very angry, very abusive relationship. And when he chose to move away to get away from me, to pull a geographic and go to Nebraska, I went and found someone to create that dynamic with. And so my last drunk was interacting with someone I'd never met before. And we got into a fight, and he pushed me into the street, and he kicked me in the head several times with a steel-toed boot. And I'm not one who ever got a DUI. I'm not one who ever ended up in an institution or jail other than a treatment center. But I am one who knows that if I pick back up, this is a progressive disease. And my disease, apparently, from what I hear, has been doing push-ups for 15 years. So if I pick back up again, most likely, if I'm lucky, the first night I would get in a fight with a guy. If I'm lucky. That's what I understand. And I think that's probably true for me. And so I ended up in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was working here in Prescott at the Gurley Street Grill. I was a bartender, and I just so happened to be working with a young lady named Kate, and she had just come to Prescott, Arizona. She was attending a treatment center after going to a major treatment center in Wickenburg, and she came here and went to treatment and continued to work, and she bartended while she was working, while she was getting sober, and I don't recommend that at all. But she was able to do it. She still does it. She's 18 years sober and she's still bartending. And what's interesting about that is she carried the message to me, and she's been able to carry the message to other people. And I hadn't seen her. When I got sober, the night after I got kicked in the head so many times, my mother ended up calling my therapist, and she asked my therapist to do an intervention on me, and the therapist did it. I heard her, and I was able to really understand and hear that my parents were never going to be in my life again if I chose not to to participate in this lifestyle. If I chose not to participate in Alcoholics Anonymous, get sober, and go to meetings, and use this actively for the rest of my life. I was told to do that, and I did it. And I don't know why I got it that day. I have no idea why in my soul, in my heart of hearts, I was able to really understand that I am an alcoholic, and I quit that day. It was the first time anyone had ever confronted me truly about my drinking, and I was able to get it the first time. It was crazy. So anyway, I called her right after that meeting. I knew that I had to give up alcohol. And she, you know, she, after many blackouts and me terrorizing her and abusing her in my blackouts and almost being fired from my job because of how I treated her when I was drinking, she still continued to 12-step me into the program. She still continued to have the principles of the steps, you know, be a part of her. And she was kind, loving, and tolerant with me, even though she probably, I mean, by all accounts, shouldn't have been. And so I wanted what she had, and I was lucky enough to have that reflected back to me. And so I ended up coming into the program, and I ended up quitting bartending and going straight to treatment. And I did not participate in relationships for a year and a half after I got sober. So the big book doesn't talk about that at all, but I do like to talk about it because I think it's really important, especially as young people, to remember that we are really not well equipped when we first come in here to deal with the feelings that come along with being in relationships and or having sex with someone without having a relationship. And it's just something that we are not well equipped for. It takes time to develop those skills. I still don't know if I'm well equipped for that. And I'm 16 years sober, and I've been working the steps over and over again in my life. It's hard. It's hard to live life. It's hard to live life on life's terms and to continue to allow that to happen. And so, you know, I don't have any belief in anything other than what the big book says, which is that we, you know, we watch our motives, and we are not to be judges of or arbiters of anyone else's sex conduct. But what I do know is that that is what worked for me, and I see a lot of people relapse over relationships and early recovery, and sex and love can be used as a drug just like anything else, and. We have a major epidemic in the United States, in the world, of opiate addiction and drug overdoses. It is one of the leading causes of death in the United States. This is a problem. This is a terminal illness. People are dying left and right from this. And, you know, and there are many people in this room that may die from this disease. And that's a very sad fact, and it's also very true. And so if there's anything that I can impart to you tonight, it is to allow yourself the opportunity to really dig into this and be of service and allow yourself what Bill and Bob ultimately wanted for everyone, which is basically service. Everything comes down to service. Everything comes down to love. Everything comes down to connection to another person and being of service and demonstrating that love and service through connection. And if you can get that and really enjoy it, really allow it to sink in and truly get high off of that, then that would be worth it for you because there's no other better feeling than the high that comes from being of service. So, I mean, maybe there's some others, but that might be considered service work too, though. So, anyway. I It's so funny. I used to have parties at my house when I first got sober. Nikki used to come over. There are a few people in this room that actually used to come to my house, and we would have huge parties. I would basically pass out flyers at meetings, and I would have potlucks, and I would have everybody bring food, and we'd play spades, and we'd have a pool table, and we'd have different rooms for different themes, and it was awesome. We used to do that all the time, and I loved being able to do that. I haven't been able to do it in other towns. When I moved away from Prescott and moved to San Diego, I did not find that kind of fellowship in San Diego. It just wasn't there for me the way it was here. This is a very special place, and if you're getting sober here or you live here, enjoy it. Enjoy it while it lasts. Really, really just truly get into it. And then when you leave, which you very well may do, take it with you and share it with everybody else. Because what we have here is very special. It doesn't happen everywhere. I've lived in a lot of cities since I've been sober, and it really is a great place. And the young people's groups here are amazing, and they've been amazing for a really long time. So this is a great place and a great meeting. And I'm just gonna be quiet and let Chris get on up here. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Melissa. Appreciate it. And for tonight's main speaker, Chris W.
Thanks, guys. My name is Chris. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Chris. We love you, Chris. Lots and lots and lots.
Come on.
You guys are awesome. Before I start, anybody on the host committee, can you please stand? Host committee, stand. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. The service that you guys are doing in this conference has had a spectacular start already, and I'm really looking forward to the rest of it. I probably won't learn much in the next 45 minutes, and hopefully somebody will gain something from my experience, strength, and hope. So my sobriety date is June 28th, 1993. I had the opportunity to take a look at my life and what was going on 10 days before my 19th birthday. And I'm super grateful that the same sobriety date from when I walked in my first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting is still my sobriety date today. That's been through work, and I'll get into some of the details of that. I do have a home group. Home groups are good. 7850 Knuckleheads. It's a men's stag meeting that meets in Scottsdale, Arizona, Sunday nights, 8 p.m. If you're a male alcoholic, I'd love to see you there. We can fit this room. Not in that room, but nevertheless, show up if you're ever in Scottsdale Sunday night. I do have a sponsor. His name is Mark S. And I was told that those three things are extraordinarily important. Sobriety date, a home group, and a sponsor. Now, sobriety date's interesting because there's a lot of dates that exist in my life, right? I have a beautiful wife that's in the audience here. That we got married on 7/7/07. That's a really special day to me. You know, my boys were born on... Alright, here we go. So, my boys were born, I have an August 1st, 2010 son, and I have a December 11th, 2008 son. Very important dates, I'll never forget them. But without my sobriety date, those dates mean nothing to me. That comes first. It's the most important date that exists. My wife is not offended by that. Her sobriety date is more important than any of those dates as well. 10 years ago, I had an opportunity to speak on Friday night at ASCII PAW in Flagstaff, Arizona. In the dark. And it's really special to be back up here, because 10 years have transpired and a lot of things have happened. That night I was stalking this beautiful young lady in the second row, and it was that night that she finally surrendered, which was good. Special evening. We literally walked through Safeway. She grabbed my hand. She had never grabbed my hand before, and I knew it's on. This is a really special conference for me. My first ASCII PAW as well was in 2002, and it's a really neat place. So let me back up a little bit and. Just kind of start with a couple things that help me sort of maintain my spot here. And I want to thank Jeff F. for this sort of run on this bit. So, if you've ever blank, you might be an alcoholic. So here we go. If you've ever tried to outrun the police either on foot or via car, you might be an alcoholic. If you've ever classified your greatest asset as your ability to lie and get away with it, you might be an alcoholic. If you've ever came to in another town, state, or country, you might be an alcoholic. If you've ever drank boxed wine straight out of the turkey neck, you might be an alcoholic. Yes. My wife's favorite. If you've ever fallen out of the car during a traffic stop, you might be an alcoholic. Yes. If you've ever had an intimate relationship with a pawn shop, you might be an alcoholic. If you've ever attempted to speak a foreign language you knew nothing of, you might be an alcoholic. If you've ever thrown up on your pillow, you might be an alcoholic. If you've ever used the words beer 30, you might be an alcoholic. If you've ever smuggled alcohol into a wedding, a funeral, a sporting event, or math class, you might be an alcoholic. My people. God, I love this. And for my older friends in the audience, such as myself, if you've ever made an attempt to recreate the sitcom Cheers in your life, you might be an alcoholic. My personal favorite was Norm. So let's dive in here a little bit. I grew up in Portland, Oregon. Anybody from Portland, Oregon here? Yes, my people. So Portland, Oregon is a beautiful place, and I grew up in a beautiful home. Great family, no neglect. I wasn't locked up in small cages as a child. I didn't have things going on. The bottom line is my insides didn't match my outsides, right? So I had this really loving family, and I developed this self-hatred. Now, it didn't start out that way. Let me sort of show you where it started. I had two examples in my life, and I'm going to call one the devil. That's my oldest sister. And the angel, which was my middle sister. And I saw very two distinct advantages on how to approach childhood by these two older gals. And my oldest sister, who was, she's like 5'9" in like fifth grade, she was taking dad's car out at 12. And my other sister, the angel, would work, really, really hard for months on end to bring home great grades, and that would quickly be overshadowed by my older sister, throwing a party and there'd be naked pictures of her in the cereal boxes. I'm just using some general examples right now, okay? General examples. This isn't recorded, right? Okay. That's right, we already went over that. So these two examples existed in my life, and what I saw was that if you had good behavior, it didn't pay off. And so I went ahead and applied for an internship with my oldest sister. Now, I'm going to back up slightly. So I'm going to tell you about my first drink, because it was really special. My first drink was Chablis box wine out of the turkey neck. And I went ahead and chased that with a Virginia Slims menthol cigarette. You only have one story. If you don't relapse, you have one story. You got to stick with it, right? Like, it wasn't Jack Daniels with a Pall Mall afterwards, right? My dad didn't drink, right? Don't place blame. My mom had that box of wine always in there. So I remember a really distinct experience when, I don't know, anybody ever sneak out in the summer times when they were kids? Yes, sneaking out, right? So you gotta sleep out on the deck, look like you're camping at home. And, totally had the parents fooled. They just thought we loved nature, right? So I'm out sleeping, acting like we're sleeping, then we go out and, run. Anyway, it was apparently a slow night for the police department that night. Wasn't a lot going on. And we're like up in like my elementary school park. And people are lighting stuff. Now, granted, I'm 11. Okay, so I'm also not, I haven't gotten that much taller since I got sober. I'm slightly taller than I was at 11. But nevertheless, I was short. And because I was short, I was also very slow, and that was the only sort of general concern of my older sister. But I think she was kind of working that to her advantage, right? If somebody's getting caught, that's me. What I knew is that we were drinking, and somebody was smoking something that smelled funny, and next thing I know, there was a spotlight on us that was brought to us by a helicopter. And this was back when we didn't have an oil crisis and they used helicopters to enforce curfew. And interesting use of resources, I think, now. So anyway, also the police decided to scare the crap out of us by coming in on both sides with their squad units through the grass. And so everybody just scattered and we, just started running. And and I just remember, like, my heartbeat coming through my neck, right? And I hadn't felt my heartbeat in my neck at that point in my life. And we're just, like, running, and it was just mass hysteria. We go and hide underneath a deck, right, with firewood, and we're just hanging out. And you can hear dogs barking and cars going by and stuff. And then it all sort of got quiet. And they went away, and they didn't catch us. And I remember walking out on the street, right? And I just thought, that's awesome, right? Like, I did not have a normal reaction to that, right? Most normal kids would be like, I'm 11, I should probably just go home, right? And I was like, no, bring it on, more cops. And so, unfortunately, my drinking brought more cops. I continued to drink Chablis box wine, not for the taste, though, guys. It wasn't that tasty at 10, But, you look at my life, I was really a normal 10 or 11-year-old drinker. That gets a totally different reaction in North Scottsdale, by the way. They're like, what? You drank at that? So, I now look at 10-year-olds and I'm disgusted that I would think that even any one of these would take a drink, right? It's like, what? That blows me away, but nevertheless. So, I spent a lot of time with my oldest sister and I liked the effect produced by alcohol, man. It made me feel taller. It made me feel stronger. It made me feel a part of. It made me feel like I could dance, right? And I thought, if this feels so good, why should we ever limit it to certain days of the week, right? Let alone certain times of the week, right? So I started sort of weaving it in, right, to other things, like math and church, we didn't go to church, but there was always like some event going on at a church. I really like bar mitzvahs because they like didn't keep tabs on alcohol there at all, and like you're just walking away with bottles and their parents like, oh, go for it, right? You're like, wow, this is really crazy, totally new rules when there's a bar mitzvah going on. So I started like hanging out with younger people that were like right around 13, right? So I passed through this invisible line, and sixth grade was relatively normal. Seventh grade, I got suspended 17 times. And my parents are like, what has happened, right? Like the wheels came off. And they didn't really ask me about it, nor would I tell them. But I didn't really like school. And they had this really cool concept, whereas if you were, if you were an idiot in class and threw stuff and swore, that you got to no longer have to go to class. And I'm like, that's genius, right? Like, it should be the opposite. Like, you should have to do more class if that's the case. You know, like with a really strict instructor. I think they're, you know, turning some things around now. But at that point, I just spent a lot of my year in suspension. If you did something really bad, ooh, they sent you home. I'm like, really? You send me home? That's awesome. Even better. I don't have to stay in school and, you know, make holes in my pants. Awesome. So I just started getting suspended a lot. My parents just really didn't know what this was about, but I was like, get me home where the box wine was and the Virginia Slims. Like, I didn't really know any other alternatives, guys. Like, it wasn't a personal decision at this point. When you're 11, shoulder tapping is like really hard, especially when you're 4 feet tall. There's a lot of no's, and I just didn't handle rejection very well. So, ultimately what I ended up doing was, I got involved with a crowd that started getting involved in other things that especially involve like tracers now, right? Like, you know, other activities. You know, I could relate to the hallucinogens and, just different concoctions. Alcohol was always involved in the equation, right? But there was, we were getting more creative. And, like artistically creative and stuff. And so... You know, I ended up finding myself where, it was interesting because I started seeing that my friends were changing over time, right? But I always had to have like that one guy that was like way worse than I was. And that was just like my point of comparison. You know, it's like, at least I'm not like Slow Joe, right? Like, there was always something that I needed to grab onto. And so when I was in fifth grade, there was an opportunity in fifth grade to be able to help some Cambodian kids how to speak English. And what I heard is you can get out of class. So I went ahead and did that. And it was so funny because, I think I may have taught this Cambodian kid a couple of swear words, but that was about it. But what I remember is that like in grade 6 through about, 11, I kept holding on to that, right? Like I would do something really terrible, like go hawk loose diamonds from my great-grandmother's wedding ring. But then I'd be like, but I at least taught that Cambodian kid how to read, right? And so I just had this really whacked perception on life, and I was extraordinarily delusional. But I took like that one incident. I didn't have any other incidents other than that one thing of where I helped somebody, and I didn't help that guy. But but at the time I took that, and man, I took that thing to the bank, and I cashed that check every day of like, yeah, I'm a good guy. Of course I am. You know, if you leave your car unlocked, of course I'm going to break in, right? Like, so. My behavior. So none of the things that I did that where I broke the law made me alcoholic, but they were all were fueling something that was going on inside of me, and that I was raised in such a way that I knew what right the difference between right and wrong was. I didn't care, and the reality at the end of the day was I wanted what I wanted when I wanted it, and selfishness and self-centeredness started completely controlling my life in every aspect, and. And I started waking up and saying, I need to be under the influence of something. I don't care what it is. I just need to be, I need to get back to that edge. I like what I felt like on Friday night, so why not feel like that on Tuesday morning? That seems like, that makes perfect sense. So I started doing that, but it's a vicious cycle, as we all know. I'm so happy to be in a room of winners, guys. I'm so happy to be in a room of people that made it through an unbelievable experience and sit here. I have so much respect for you that you can sit here and be a part of a conference and be a part of a program. It's unbelievable. Don't underestimate that. There's so many people. For every one of you, there's at least 10 that haven't been able to make it in this door. They either don't know it's a reality, or that what's happening is that their mind is telling them that they don't need this, or that this is something different, or that it's a cult, or whatever else. So I'm so happy you're here. At the time, though, I felt so different. I had terminal uniqueness. If you had my problems, you would drink too, is what my mind would always say. And so what ended up happening was... I stole a bunch of money from a bank. That's, you know, that's progression. So, up to that point, I had had a slap on the wrist for just about everything that I'd done up to that point. Except for, well, there was one thing. I went shopping with my dad when I was 16 years old, and I didn't want to lose a good opportunity we were shopping, and we went to Costco, and I had perfectly good intentions of stealing a carton of cigarettes. Not Virginia Slims this time. And so I was gonna steal a carton of cigarettes, and I didn't realize they had them all locked up. They were all in cages, right, you know, for people like me. And and the thought crossed my mind is, you can't leave here without something, right? Guys, I got tackled in the parking lot for an MC Hammer CD. Yeah. Can't touch this, that's right. Now, if I would have been wearing my parachute pants, I probably would have gotten away with it. Didn't go well in those jeans. So, I was with my dad. My dad left me there and said, take him. He wanted to have them take me to jail and all sorts of stuff. And they're like, dude, it's a CD. But nevertheless, when I fast forward and I got to the point that that I had crimes of a magnitude that took me to prison, things got real. I haven't gotten much skinnier or taller since I got sober. I'm not like prison material. I am prison material, but something totally different. Prison material. So that scared me. It scared me so much that there was a revelation that things might not be normal in my life at that point. And by that point it was, I was consumed, you know, I had started my own business at that point. Selling drugs, and there was, I did not have an employable record at all, and I dropped out of high school. It really wasn't working with my schedule, and I eventually ended up being homeless. And I remember getting that day that I got, you know, the boot, right? And I just thought, man, my mom must be having a really tough day, right? You know? And I found myself, guys, I didn't last long in a homeless environment. I just, you know, like, it suddenly dawned on me that I was the loser. I was the last to figure out what the loser that I was. What I also figured out was that I was a delusion that I was still having fun. I was a victim of this delusion that Friday nights and Saturday nights were still fun. And I would show up to places and I was miserable. Because I could no longer relate to people, right? Because most of the people that were doing things that I were doing were in prison, right? So like most normal people were talking about, you know, like work, boring, right? Like college, I'm like, whatever, right? Like they weren't talking about anything fun. There was nothing going on there, and so ultimately, I found myself back on the steps of my parents' house, I did not have a belief that I had a problem with alcohol or any other substance at that point. I had a bad luck problem at that point. I was convinced of that, so my dad saw me sitting out there, you know. I'll paint the picture too. Everything that I owned clothes wise were underneath the house, on top of the wood pile. The spare key was gone. I was not trusted or wanted around, you know, my household, right? People that had unconditional love for me no longer wanted me around. I thought of suicide on a daily basis. I wanted the noise to end, and that noise was I needed to quiet it every day. And the medication that I used quieted that for a period of time. But man, the voices started getting louder and louder and louder. And so I got scared and went back and sat down. And my dad came out and said, "You need some help." I agreed with him. I definitely needed some help. Like $20 would have helped me out too at that point. And he said, "Hey, if you're open to it, I'm willing to. I'm open to give you one last chance." And the best thing that I could come up with at that point was, I got to think about it. guys, I had a lot going on. This is, I can't make rash decisions, right? And but what that really meant was I need to get drunk and think about this, right? And I went and had that last night. And that was on June 27th. And that last night, and it was miserable, right? It was just miserable. And I came back and I said, okay, let's do this, right? You know, go take me somewhere and teach me how to drink like a gentleman, right? Or whatever that looked like, I didn't know. And so I show up to this place and they went through all my stuff, you know, and they took out everything cool. And then I was like, hey, you know, like, I need to, you know, you guys have at least like something I can read or something, right? Like, you know, books or anything? And they're like, you bet. So they handed me this blue book, and I thought, well, that looks like an interesting new Bible. You know, I just didn't have any like flash on it, and I said, oh, cool, there's no pictures. Do you guys have any magazines or anything, right? And they're like, sure, right, here's some grapevines. And they weren't really getting it, so I found out I ended up going to a really serious, I went to a really serious treatment facility. Now, if you're in treatment, awesome. If you're not in treatment, awesome. There's not a requirement for sobriety to go through treatment. I want to make sure that's extraordinarily clear. I knew nothing of Alcoholics Anonymous. If my dad would have came out on those steps and said, you need to go to AA, I probably would be dead right now. Because AA wasn't the place that I was going to go to, right? I had street cred. Right? Right? Why would you show up to AA, right? Like, what AA looks like is not this, right? Like, AA was like winos, you know, that still had poop in their pants and they were in a meeting, right? Like, I'm just gonna, like, break it down. And I wasn't really interested in making friends with those folks. And so, I used this false image to allow me to stay sick. And the facility that I went to, started taking me to meetings. And if the facility, if you're in a facility right now and they take you to meetings, thank them. Because I know places that don't take them to meetings and there's this shock when they get out. Mm-hmm. Which is usually followed by relapse, but it's usually a big shock, right? And, because what I found is that meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous help alcoholics. Now, I want to be very clear. That's not the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's meeting makers make it. If that's ever told to you, it's partially true. But if that's the only thing you do is going to meetings, you're probably not going to survive. The reality is that we have to get involved in the steps. We have to get involved. The entire purpose of this book is to introduce you to a power greater than yourself that will solve your problem. That's the purpose of Alcoholics Anonymous. This camaraderie is awesome. I love it. I dig it. I feed off your guys' energy. I need it. But what I need more is a relationship with a power greater than myself. Because without that, I have no connection with you guys. Without my higher power, I don't get plugged in. Without my higher power, I don't show up here, guys. I stay holed up in my place filled with fear, wanting to kill people. That's just where I end up. And putting the plug in the jug is not the answer. In fact, that's how you can create a really psychotic alcoholic at that point. Right? We gotta get busy. And, so, I'm gonna tell you a few examples of some of the things that I saw in Alcoholics Anonymous early. About 2 weeks in, there was an H&I meeting that was brought into the facility that I was at. And these guys came in and they had graduated, dangerous word, graduated from that facility. They had left there and they had stayed sober for a period of time. And they brought a meeting back, which was so awesome. And what they looked around the room, it was a candlelight meeting. And they looked around the room and they said, you know, we're not here to discourage anybody, but less than half of you are staying sober after leaving this facility. And I looked around and I was like, there's no way, right? There's no way. There's a lot. I didn't go to an adolescent facility. I was, like I said, I turned 19 in treatment. And, so I was the youngest by about 20 years in the place that I went. And I saw, it was like, this voice came over me that said, you can get sober now or you can get sober later. Mm-hmm. what I did was I started looking around the room, and I'm like, less than half, like the statistic baffled me, right? People seemed like they were beaten into a state of reasonableness. Why wouldn't they grab onto that? Why wouldn't they stay so? Why, that doesn't make sense to me. And I realized at that point that everybody was looking at me going, poor kid, right? And this voice overcame me in my head, and it said, you're going to be one of the guys that makes it. Guys, I wasn't an overly positive individual. I had been kicked out of the Boy Scouts and had gone to 3 schools in 3 years. Each had said, bye-bye. That wasn't my style. Like, that wasn't me. I don't know. I didn't know what that was at the time. If you would have told me it was God, I would have probably ran. So I'm glad that I had the educational variety spiritual experience, which I later found out that was God working in my life. And but more important than that voice was what followed that voice. Because what followed that voice was the next day, I'm in group, and they said, you need to do step one. And I'm like, whoa, right? Well, we're moving a little fast here, right? I'm going to be here for a while, right? And the voice said, if you want to be one of the guys that makes it, you're going to do that, right? All right, pen to paper, let's go, right? In everything that it was going on, right? Prayer. Didn't want to do it. I'll tell you about my first prayer experience. I had a roommate. He's about 84 years old. Previously owned a bar, had aspirations to turn it into an ice cream store. His name was Bill W. He was like out, like reading the paper or something, drinking some coffee, and they had told me that I needed to get on my, they suggested, right, and suggestions. If you hear suggestions around here, it's the same suggestion that if you jump out of an airplane, they suggest you pull the ripcord. I didn't realize that at the time. It seemed really soft and fluffy. But they suggested that I get on my knees and pray. And so I just totally remember the moment. I look down the hall, make sure Bill W's still down there reading the paper, right? I close the door, right? I look underneath the door to see the gap, right? I'm like, ooh, God forbid somebody see me on my knees praying, right? Like, people found me naked in their front yard when I was drinking, right? But like, my ego was screaming at me not to get on my knees. I know what voice that was that was screaming not to get on my knees. I know what that voice is today. That voice sometimes tells me what kind of guy I am, right? It tells me that I'm a piece of S, right? I certainly hope that my lack of profanity offends no one tonight. It's something that I'm working on, right? I don't know who's going to listen to this, right? And if a newcomer listens to this and they have beliefs in certain words that they find inappropriate, and that's their wedge between them and Alcoholics Anonymous, that's not on me. I can't own that. So I'm going to stand up here tonight and not use those. If you want to talk afterwards, we'll cuss like sailors. But from up here, it's my goal not to. So what that voice said was, I need to get on my knees and pray. What that voice said was, When I got out, they said, you need to do 90 meetings in 90 days. And that voice came back and said, if you want to be one of the guys that makes it, you're going to do 90 meetings in 90 days. Right? And, man, it was one thing after another. They said, get a sponsor. I want to be one of the guys that makes it. Apparently, I got to go get a sponsor. Right? And I didn't know what a sponsor was. I thought, I thought it was like guys that like bet on how long you stay sober. Like, I was like, it was weird. I didn't know the concept. And I could go to my sponsor and ask him what a sponsor was. So it was like really confusing. But finally somebody broke it down for me, right? It was somebody that had been through the steps before that was willing to take me through the steps, right? Somebody that was willing to introduce me to other alcoholics. And it was somebody that I could be rigorously honest with. Somebody that would be unaffected by everything that I would tell them. Right? My dad's a great guy. I just can't really go and, lay out my fifth step to him, right? It was more important to do that with a sponsor. And, I ended up getting my first service commitment at what was my home group. And my first service commitment wasn't nearly as cool because I got it done really quick, which was getting cards for people that had birthdays. I looked at the birthday list and went to the store. I was done for a year. That wasn't as cool as being the coffee guy. And at 6 months sober, they said, they don't use Robert's Rules of Order in some meetings. They don't have elections. And they were like, you're the coffee guy. And I'm like, I don't even know. I'd never drank a cup of coffee in my life at that point. I don't even know how it's supposed to taste, right? And they're like, don't worry about it. It's simple. And they're like, here's the key. And the previous coffee guy, that's this guy, he will be here next week. He didn't show. So I get up there at 7 o'clock. It's Friday night. I remember it's the We're Doing It group on Martin Ozzie in Tualatin, Oregon. I remember this stuff. I hope you remember these really key poignant moments in your sobriety and you hold on to them. And I just remember I show up at 7 and I just go and try and figure this thing out, and I pull out this big metal urn that was donated to him from a prison or something, and I was like, I don't know, I found the coffee, right, and I pull out the big metal thing. Well, it was really old, and I didn't see the line inside of it where you fill the coffee to, so I filled it up. I know now, but and then I just went ahead and turned it on, right? We got other stuff to set up, right? And in 7:30, in walks Joe, and I'm like, meeting doesn't start till 8, Joe, right? And he said, I come here at 7:30 every Friday. And I was like, why? He said, I set up the chairs. And I said, okay. And then somebody else walked in. And somebody else walked in. And I started seeing the meeting before the meeting. Guys, up to that point, I hadn't seen the meeting before the meeting. If meetings start at 8, I get there right around 8. Not much earlier. And when the meeting's over, it's time to go, right? And so in this particular one, it was a 45-minute breakdown and cleanup. And I saw how many people stayed after that. I literally just thought the church left all of our stuff set up all the time. I thought the chairs were always there, the 12 steps and 12 traditions were always on the wall. I didn't realize they were actually put them up and took them down every meeting. But what I saw was what people were doing before the meeting and what they did after the meeting. And I started finding out guys that were in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I started getting to know Joe a little bit after every Friday. And Friday night was a great time for me to be in a meeting. And I started seeing Joe on a frequent basis, and I found out more about him and his wife and, where they came from. And he was a pastor, and he drove a Lincoln Continental. And he was I just found out more and more about him, and that was, really cool. And I started feeling a connection to that meeting. I remember getting 1 year sober and really feeling connected to that meeting. And if I would have shown up at 8 and left at 9, I wouldn't have a significant connection to that meeting. And that was a really, really important turning point in my sobriety. And I started seeing that it's very similar to a gym membership. There's lots of people that are members of a gym. There's a lot less that show up and work out. Alcoholics Anonymous is the same way. We got lots of members, right? But it's really the 80-20 principle, right? In any given meeting, about 20% of the people do about 80% of the work. And it's really important. I'm not going to be the 20% at every meeting, but I'm definitely going to be the 20% at least one of my meetings, which is going to be my home group. And I found out that if I do that, I'm a lot safer and protected inside Alcoholics Anonymous. So, let me talk about a couple things that I established. So when I was 13 years old, I ended up getting braces and hot look. They weren't like braces like today where they're clear and stuff. They were metal with fluorescent rubber bands in them and stuff. And they ended up moving, they put them on, and I was like, oh, these aren't bad. And they're like, come back in a week. And they tightened them, right? Anybody ever had braces? They tightened them, right? And I'm just like, just unbearable pain. About a week later, that pain went away. And 3 weeks later, I was back in, and they tightened them again, right? And over the course of 3 years, they moved my teeth back to perfect, beautiful teeth. And they took my braces off. And they took paper mache and shoved it in my mouth. And they said, we need to take a mold of your teeth. I thought that they were going to put it on display. And they were beautiful. But they were creating what are known as retainers. And they made these retainers and they handed them to me. And they said, wear these. We suggest you wear them every night. And I'm like, dude, I just got my braces off. I'm not wearing anything. And so a week later, curiosity kicked in. I was like, I should probably try those on. And I went to put them on. Oh, it was tight, right? I thought, that's really weird. I woke up in the morning and they were loose. They popped right out. I waited another week. I went to put them in, really tight. And what happened was in that week, my teeth shifted. I didn't know it. I couldn't feel my teeth shifting. The exact same thing happens for me in Alcoholics Anonymous. I have no idea when I'm shifting spiritually. My wife has no idea when I'm, well, she probably has a better idea when I'm shifting spiritually. But I have no idea when I'm shifting spiritually. Right? And what Alcoholics Anonymous does is it provides me, just like my retainers for my teeth, right? I'm 40 years old now, and I still wear those same retainers. And if I wait anything longer than a week, they hurt to put in. Because after all this time, they still shift. And my spiritual connection still shifts. Alcoholics Anonymous, when I work the steps, when I do service work, when I get involved in the lives of others, when I attend meetings, I get back to center, right? When I pray to God, when I spend that quiet time, I get back to center, right? And I never necessarily know how far I'm off until somebody's pissed me off in traffic, right? Right? Or some little event, somebody makes some little slight, you know, sort of sleight of hand comment, right? And I just kind of bristle, right? And I want to punch somebody in the throat, right? And I realize at that very moment, wow, I'm off, right? But what's interesting about when I'm off, I'm like, whatever, I'm off, right? Because once I'm off, I'm not all that stoked about getting back to spiritual center again, right? So it's going to be important for me to stay involved in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, right? And I liken it to a herd of zebras, right, out on the African plain, right? And the ones that are in the center have a tendency to stay safe and protected. And the ones that are on the outside get picked off. And I just got to stay in the center. Whatever that looks like for me, whatever staying in the center looks like. And it's so awesome to be able to see people around at other meetings and people that are taking an active part in their recovery. And it's so inspirational for me to see my wife working the program and working with sponsees and doing what she does to keep our family and our life spectacular. Guys, if Alcoholics Anonymous stopped working, I would have stopped coming a long time ago. A long time ago. Right? If I could get by with one meeting a week, I might. I only need one meeting a year. I just don't know which one it is. So I got to go to a lot. The reality for me is that I originally considered myself cursed to be put in, you know, to have to come to Alcoholics Anonymous. And what I know now today is that I'm one of the most blessed men that I know on the planet. Because I get to come here. I get to. I don't have to, unless I'm speeding, I don't really have to get freaked out by the cops, right? Like, I used to be petrified of the police always, right? And what I found out in college statistics is that if you break the law every day, you're bound to get caught. It also breeds an unbelievable amount of paranoia. And I'm so happy to be free of that paranoia today. And I'm happy just to be free. In general, I'm just happy to be free. And so let me talk a little bit about sort of what my life looks like today. Because, you know, I sort of painted a picture of what my life looked like before I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was a high school dropout, and I had the opportunity to finish high school. It was amazing what I found out when I actually showed up for class. It was really spectacular. I actually didn't have to do that much homework. If I just actually showed up for class and I was attentive, I did relatively well. And I got done with that, and my dad said, awesome, I'm willing to help with college. And I said, I'm not ready. And that it crushed him, you know, because he felt like that was going to send me off in a direction. And I told him, I said, you've done so much for me. At this point, for me to compromise that because I'm not ready isn't fair to you. And so I went and got ready. And I went and got on a plane, and I went to Maui, Hawaii, and I bought a 1977 Volkswagen bus, and I lived in that, and I went to meetings every day, and I just, like, I lived a dream that I always dreamed, right? But before I got sober, like, I literally thought my life was over, Right? When somebody's like, oh, you're gonna need to go to AA, I'm like, my life's over, right? It's officially over. And what I figured out later is that my life was actually already over. I was just sort of the last one to figure that out, right? Like, I didn't want to leave my house because I lied to everybody and was, you know, I had genuine fear of the police and other people. But, you know, when you just steal a lot of stuff, it just sort of happens. And so it was like, but I was under this delusion that I was living this, you know, great life and the fear was once I got sober, I was just going to become square, right? And that, I'm probably pretty square today, but whatever. I got two kids and, sort of settling into square right now. So what I also assumed was that Alcoholics Anonymous was a cult. And then I thought, man, you guys, you know, maybe, you know, for the first few meetings, you kind of prettied it up a little bit. Right, but there was going to be a time I was going to need to start going door to door and selling books. I knew that was coming.
Oh my God.
And I was really refreshed when that wasn't part of the deal. Right? You guys haven't asked, you haven't asked much of me. And, this is certainly a $1 million program, but it's doled out a nickel at a time. And what I do know is that I have to invest. And this is there's a program of action that's identified in this big book, and if you don't have a sponsor, I suggest getting one. If you don't have a home group, I suggest getting one. Go to the business meetings of that home group. Get a service position at that home group. Become a cog in the wheel of Alcoholics Anonymous. But work the steps. If we don't get down to causes and conditions, we've simply put a plug in the jug, and we're just waiting for the next opportunity to kill somebody, and it might be ourselves. I've been too many, you know, like, the reality, if you've been around for a little while, go buy a suit. You're gonna need them, right? You're gonna go to a fair amount of, weddings, and you're gonna go to a fair amount of funerals. And I don't wanna get all sappy on you, but that's the reality, right? And, you know, carry a casket, right? See a broken, you know, mother and father as a result of alcoholism and drug addiction. See that. Experience that. That's life. I avoided life on life's terms as much as I could. I didn't like life. Right? I wanted to just check out. Now in sobriety, I face everything. Right? If it comes, I face it. I haven't found anything in my life that a drink wouldn't make worse. Right? That's the reality. The most important thing I can pass on to you guys is don't let the life that AA gave you get in the way of your AA life. I'll repeat it. Don't let the life that AA gave you get in the way of your AA life. You're gonna get a cool life. You're gonna start looking pretty cool. You're gonna start feeling pretty cool. You're not gonna stink. Other people might like you. Employers might want you to actually come and work for their, you know, for their company. People are gonna want you playing their softball team. Your grandparents might want you back at their house. You might have a child. You might go to college. You might become a teacher. All that stuff is fantastic. But if we desert Alcoholics Anonymous, odds are very, very good you'll go back to drinking. And everything that you've worked up to that point gets flushed down the toilet in a very short amount of time. Don't let the life that AA gave you get in the way of your AA life. On the bottom of page 14 in Bill's story, it breaks it down, and it says, "For if an alcoholic fails to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others, he could not survive the certain trials and low spots ahead." Guys, there are certain trials and low spots ahead. Have it be a healthy fear. The reality is, I want to be ready. I want to be ready. I don't know what call I'm going to get. I was on the golf course today up in Flagstaff. I got this text, and it said, "Bad accident" is the way that the text message started. Bad accident. And it went on to say that there was a bad accident on the freeway. But when I first read it, right, it was like, oh, my ticket's been punched, right? Like, I literally thought my wife and children had been in a bad accident, right? And it was like, I need to be ready for that. I need to be ready for the day that I get a phone call that somebody that I absolutely love and cherish in this world is no longer here. I need to be ready. Right? I can't hang out on the edges of Alcoholics Anonymous and wait for that stuff to happen and go, I'll be ready then. I'll go to meetings then. It won't happen. Right? My house can't burn down and me call an insurance company and say, can you insure my house now? Not happening, right? They're not doing it. They say, you're SOL, chief. That's it. Like, I literally can't do that in AA. Right? So I got to continue to invest. And what end up, how I invest in Alcoholics Anonymous is I put in a nickel and I get a dime. That's how it's paid back. Sometimes later. Put in a nickel, it comes back as a dime. Every time, right? The amount that I put in, I get more back. It defies the laws of physics. For every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. Not in Alcoholics Anonymous. We defy physics here. Put in a little, get a shit ton back. Oh, man, I just swore. Sorry. I get emotional about stuff. And, okay. Man, so I hope you walk away with one thing, is that I love Alcoholics Anonymous. 21 years of sobriety did not actually mean that much to me. And for the simple reality that I can't use that as my excuse to say, I'm kicking back, I'll let other people do it, right? No, I continue to fight for cigarette guy at my home group, right? And they're not giving it to me because they're saying, no, we want to give it to the newcomer. What about me, right? I want to do something. And so if you're not getting a service position at your home group, appoint yourself one. Be the setup person. Be the cleanup person. Be the greeter. Be the high fiver. Do whatever you want. Create your own service position. You don't even need to be elected. Just do it. Right? Just become a cog in the wheel. It's so critical. And what I find is that when I'm a cog in the wheel, that life rolls off me like water off a duck's back. And when I get news and when I get things that happen, life on life's terms, all right. I get this sense of perspective. I'm gonna wrap up with this. The disease of alcoholism is a disease of perception. And that what ends up happening to me is that over any period of time, I start looking at my life as though my life is not good. I start looking at things. Self-pity creeps in. Right, I look at you know, everybody that doesn't have kids, and I'm like, oh man, I wish I didn't have kids. Right? I wish I could sleep in. Right? I wish I didn't have to change diapers. Right? Like, I don't have to do that anymore. But that's what you get with a 4 and 5 year old. But the reality is that I can get distorted perception in a really short amount of time, and that when I'm involved in the lives of others, and when I'm picking up the phone and I'm talking to people, I find out that the problems that I have, the things that I call problems, people would pay for them. People, if there was a problem swap, people would, I'd have people lined up out the door, right? But yet, in my own mind, I just make everything completely blown out of proportion. Now granted, guys, I have problems in areas that I didn't used to have areas, right? There's like all new stuff to apply the program of Alcoholics Anonymous to. And it's just up to me of whether I'm going to step up and do it every day. Gosh, it's easy to get busy. Man, oh man, is it. But it says that alcohol is a subtle foe. Right? Resting on my laurels is a really dangerous thing. And I'm honored that anybody would ever ask me to come up here and share my story in front of you guys. I'm honored. I was scared to talk to one person when I got sober, right? You know, let alone a group of people. And through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, you guys have gotten me up in front of people. And as a result of that, companies have gotten me up in front of their employees, right? And what you guys taught me, I've now been able to make a career with the tools that you've passed on to me. So thank you. Otherwise I'd be sitting in this room talking to myself. And man, I hope you guys get a whole bunch out of this weekend. The last thing my buzzkill thought of the for the weekend is be careful. Be careful in the lives that you're impacting. Right? And this is fun, and we have a great time. But broken hearts can sometimes equal more drinks. And just be super cautious about our motives. And make sure that we're communicating with people. Make sure that we're being super respectful with others. And man, you guys are unbelievable. I'm super excited for the rest of this conference, and thank you so much. Yeah.